You all had so many questions from the first round that we had to make it two episodes. So here we are with our part two of our Q&A series, where we cover topics like how we, Dr. Leah and I, both personally handle conflict with our partners, if lanolin use is safe for nipple healing and babies, how much we both weigh, and how to handle people around you wearing perfume. We also talk about melatonin in pregnancy and caffeine in pregnancy. And then what about if you and your partner disagree on the number of children to have? We get into some really good nitty-gritty details around general conflict resolution in this episode, which is something that not enough people are talking about. So we are so happy to break open that conversation as it pertains to the world of fertility toxins on coworkers or disagreements with your spouse. Let's go.
Welcome to Healthy as a Mother, the podcast for becoming and being a mother, with your co-hosts, Dr. Leah Gordon and Dr. Morgan McDermott, two naturopathic doctors who get it.
Each week, we teach you how to be the healthiest mother you can be, from fertility and preconception to pregnancy and birth prep, through postpartum and throughout motherhood, empowering you with the natural health guidance and education you're not getting elsewhere so you can confidently navigate the broken system at large.
The real, the raw, the untalked about.
And remember, this information is not intended to diagnose, treat, or manage any disease. Always consult with your doctor before making any changes.
Alrighty, so this is going to be the part two of our Q&A section from just this one round of questions, but we had so many questions from you guys that we really couldn't possibly do it in one episode. So here we're just going to jump into the questions that we didn't get to last time, and let's just take it away. How much do both of you weigh, and have you ever struggled with your weight?
Okay, I'll start. I think I currently weigh around 125. I haven't weighed myself in a while. The lowest I've ever gotten as an adult is like 120. I think that was when I was heavily breastfeeding, because it was just, you know, you're mm-hmm. losing a lot of weight. And I gained about 20 pounds when I was pregnant, and I'm 5'5".
What? You only gained 20 pounds when you were pregnant?
Yeah, it was weird.
Well, that's right. You didn't really have any weight anywhere else besides your belly.
Yeah. And I eat like a football player. I eat so much food. So I'm just I have a higher than average thyroid, and I'm very vata in my constitution, meaning I eat a lot and it kind of just like evaporates away from me. I'm not a person who like puts on weight. I never really have. I was always a very big person growing up. I was way taller than everybody else and completely developed and mature with full breasts and everything in like fifth grade. So I always felt very large and had maybe body image issues back then because I was so big and developed when no one else was. And I was very puffy and inflamed because I was eating a lot of food that I think my body didn't like gluten and dairy. So when I look back at pictures of myself, I definitely had some like extra stuff, you know, and lots of inflamed looking face and all of that. But I've never had really large weight oscillations or really struggled with weight in that department. What about you?
Yeah, we both have really fast metabolisms. So mm-hmm. I mean, right now I currently weigh 168 mm-hmm. because I am 20 weeks pregnant and I'm 5'11 and a half. I'm almost 6
foot. Yeah, you're so much taller than me.
So, but my normal weight, I would say, is like I have just a natural set point weight of like 143. I would somewhere in there, like 144, 143, but I think I actually do feel better at like 150 because mm-hmm. that would be with some muscle too.
Yeah.
We both eat a lot. We both seem to have really fast metabolisms. And yes, having unwanted weight has not really been a problem for me. When I was an exchange student in Sweden when I was 18, I did gain a lot of weight that year, like 30 pounds probably. Mm-hmm. And that was tough on me because it was like – really unique. And I mean, I knew it was tough, but I don't think it was enough to say that I struggled with like body image issues necessarily. My body image issues, if I have anything, is like, I don't like my feet. They're big and long and weird and spindly, you know? And then if anything, like you were saying about feeling big, if anything, I have had my kind of insecurities revolving around being so tall and feeling like boyish body, like small breasts and not a lot of shape. And I have a booty a bit, especially
you got a good booty.
Yeah, my booty was always my saving grace because otherwise there was nothing up top, and that I did have so many insecurities about that throughout like junior high. I could not wait to get boobs. You know, I still never really got them. But you know, I'm comfortable about it now, but it did take a long time. So I guess like I think everybody has some level of insecurity. Mm-hmm. I have the opposite problem where I'm kind of always fighting to not be too thin. And I know that that's kind of a tricky thing to complain about because it's the opposite of what a lot of people struggle with. And I get that. It's still not a good thing though. It's mm-hmm. not a great thing to be too underweight. Your body struggles when you're, you know, if your blood sugar is fluctuating wildly, which mine has throughout my whole life and you as well, it's mm-hmm. like, we're just sort of an opposite end of things.
Yeah.
But to speak about your inflammation weight thing, I too have really noticed that when I look back on myself in high school and college, you know, maybe it was partially hormones. I don't know, but it's like a puffy.
Yeah. It's inflammation. We ate different back then.
Yes, exactly. We were doing crazy things and our bodies just didn't like it. And I feel really good. You know, and even cellulite, like I used to have way more cellulite than I do now. And I really think that was inflammation based, but
yes, absolutely. Yeah. And toxins, cellulite is a big toxin thing. So if you can like do a lot of lymph drainage and stuff, it helps with that.
Interesting. Yep.
Yeah.
Here, let's do one for you. What about, okay. This is kind of more of a personal one, I guess, for both of us. Mm-hmm. How do you each handle conflict in your relationship?
Good question. So I alluded to this in some of our other episodes. I don't actually know which ones. I can't remember at this time. But when I first met my husband, we dealt with conflict really avoidantly. I was taught avoidant patterns of conflict handling, which is there's a conflict, let's not talk about it. And, you know, if I'm upset, I just would give him the cold shoulder and say, oh, I'm, you know, nothing's wrong. You know, I would just look out the window and just smolder inside. I do not do that anymore. We both have done a lot of our own inner work where we've learned more emotional intelligence and how to appropriately communicate, which I highly recommend doing. And now if there's a conflict, we do what you had mentioned too in another episode where if there's emotions involved around an event or an idea or something, we state the neutral event. And never place blame on the other person or saying, you make me feel a certain way, right? And we used to do that in our relationship. We do not anymore. So an example would be, you know, when you don't – I'm trying to think of an example. We don't have a ton of conflict, but I'm just trying to think. You know, when you don't come home – this is like a super – not big conflict, but it's just like a real thing. When you come home and don't kiss me when you come home, it makes me feel like you don't care about me, you know? So I'm saying, here's the neutral event. When you come home and don't kiss me, it makes me feel, or I feel, not it makes me, I feel that, you know, I'm not loved or that there's something, you know, off between us. So stating something like that, you shared it a lot better in the last podcast, but instead of saying, you know, you don't love me or, you know, throwing out an emotional accusation is a big part of just navigating, having open communication and knowing that if basically letting each person talk and not talking over each other, you know, letting each of us kind of get our messages across. And asking permission is really big too. I think in conflict and with people, if you ask permission before you talk about a big topic, it can disarm people.
Ooh.
So let's say I need to talk to my husband about something. It's going to be way better if I say, hey, honey, can I talk to you about, you know, the tile or whatever? Can I talk to you about this thing that happened, you know? Or I'm just like, literally, I can't think of any conflict right now off the top of my head, but like, imagine, the tile is not a good conflict. We're having to redo our bathroom. So there's like things coming up with that, but asking their permission, because then if they say yes, then it's kind of like they have allowed you to step into their space to then have an uncomfortable conversation or a conversation that has emotions or bigness to it versus just kind of coming at someone with something like, we need to talk about this, you know?
Yeah,
that's a classic point. Way. Like, we need to talk about this tile problem versus, hey, honey, do you have space right now for us to talk about the tile, you know? And then if he says yes, then it's like he's accepted me into his space where we can talk about it, and it really disarms people. That's a really powerful tool that I've learned from some of the work that I've done. And this can be applied to anything, but that's another thing that we have. And asking if they have the space to talk about it. You know, I think that's a classic thing where, you know, people will come home or they'll call and just like dive right into something versus saying like, hey, do you have the bandwidth right now or do you have the space to talk? Because you can't deal with conflict and have a proper communication if the person – one, isn't ready for it, and two, is caught off guard or is busy and like their mind is somewhere else. So I would say that those are some big things, and just having compassion for the other person. Honestly, like, we don't have a lot of conflict anymore, but I think it's because we do these practices that we nip like big conflict like
in the bud.
Early on, you know, it doesn't escalate to other things. Cause I remember early in our relationship, a lot of conflict, but we don't have that really much anymore. But we've changed completely the way that we handle both ourselves and our relationship. What about you?
That was great. I think that permission thing is really good because you're so right. Just because one person's ready to talk doesn't mean the other person is. And it's really a two-way street. We need respect that somebody else might be really preoccupied in their mind by something else and they actually don't want to talk about it right now. Mm-hmm. And you can talk about it later. Mm-hmm. I would say we don't have a lot of conflict either. If anything, it's usually me getting frustrated with him and not the other way around. And that's just because I feel like I'm nitpicky sometimes. It usually has to do with the kids in our relationship. It has to do with me being like frustrated with a lack of him holding a boundary or something. Mm-hmm. He is in our relationship dynamic. I'm the sort of like authoritarian, the one that will make the rules and hold the boundaries. Sometimes I really don't like that it sort of makes me feel like I'm always the bad guy. Mm-hmm. And I wish that – and then he's sort of like fun dad. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we have actually worked on this relationship dynamic a lot throughout our relationship because it used to be a lot worse. And he would sort of like, you know, randomly buy them some sort of treat or toy or whatever. And then I was – always very consistent. If I had acted that way, we would have no money or they would always be eating sugar or da da da. So I was always the one that was like, no, it's bedtime, da da da, whatever. And, you know, I had to really express that need and to get him clear on the same page. And, you know, he was sort of doing it compensatorily, if that's a word, to make up for the ways that he wasn't fathered. It goes deep for him. And we finally had this big blowout one time. And I learned a big root crux of it for him was giving the kids all these things he didn't get from his dad. Mm-hmm. And it helped me. It turned the light bulb on in my head. I was like, oh my God. Okay. Like, I really see that. I can have so much compassion for you. You're not just weak. That's how it felt to me. I was like, you just hold the boundary. Like, everything is going to be easier. Like, you're making this more difficult for us when da da da. So when we get into those kind of conflicts, I mean, we talk about it. I don't have a structure. Although I was the one to tell you that in that podcast episode about the nonviolent communication pattern, which is where you say, when this neutral event happens, I feel like this and I need this. Mm-hmm. I don't actually do that all that often. At least consciously, maybe we do, but we'll sort of diffuse it. I tend to get really, when I'm really mad in the moment, I just need a few minutes to kind of calm down. Otherwise I can't say anything very nice.
Yeah.
Or, collect my thoughts too. Mm-hmm. I feel really scattered in my mind and sometimes I just need to talk it out and that will organize it. So sometimes we give ourselves a break. I have learned a lot about apology from him. Mm-hmm. That's something that I grew up with a lot. And so it's hard for me to do. It's really hard, but I've learned a lot. And so he's usually the one to apologize. He's very good and calm and cool and collected. He's so good at just taking uncomfortable conversations and diving into them and not knowing exactly where they're going to go. And he just feels like a rock throughout the whole thing, which is really amazing. And I don't know why he is that way, but it is grounding and helpful. It's me who's the wild card in these kinds of conflicts. Like, I'm the one that's learning. And I'm trying really hard. You know, I'm in therapy all the time and I'm always doing these different things. But It usually is just a parenting type conflict. I would say between us and our relationship, we just, you know, we've been together for 10 years. You guys have been together for a long time. You guys have been together for how long?
Oh my gosh, since 2008. So
oh my,
do the math.
a lot of years. Long, yeah, so we've been together since 2013. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But either way, it's not that much, I wouldn't say. I mean, it's little minor things. We're very similar, the same mm-hmm. goals. Lucky that way for sure. And I don't know. I don't know really what else to say. That's pretty much it. Yeah.
That's good. I love it.
Okay, let's see. Another one. Is lanolin safe for moms and babies? This is a quick one. So lanolin is a sheep-derived nipple ointment. It's usually made by a company called Lanson O. And yeah, if you're not allergic to wool, it's safe. They say the babies are not supposed to, you know, ingest a lot of that. And I would agree with that still. So mm-hmm. if you're slathering it on right before a feed for a newborn, you're maybe going to have to rub it off, which is kind of a bummer because you're probably putting it on because your nipples are damaged, and to rub it off is going to hurt really bad. Mm-hmm. So there are better options, but I do think it can be a really helpful like skin emollient because wound healing goes much better when the wound is kept wet and moisturized so that the new cells can literally slide around on each other. Versus when something is very dry, it forms this like hardened scab. And wet wounds will still form a scab. They're just a wet scab. And yes, they can mm-hmm. get ripped off easier because it's not so affixated, so fibrotic in that kind of a way. But you will have an overall better experience if it's kept wet. Something like a nipple is always going to be continually wet to an extent, unless you're only pumping maybe, but still even then it's covered in milk and whatever. I actually, if I had my preference though on nipple healing things, it's to hand express out a little milk onto your nipple, let it dry. Then if you feel like you need more something, use a nipple butter or ointment that has something like calendula in it. Mm-hmm. You know, yarrow and comfrey, yeah, for a baby to ingest large amounts of those, not ideal. But again, maybe you're doing this right after a feed when you know you have at least like a 2-hour window and it'll absorb into your skin by then and it's fine. So the problem with lanolin, it can be that if you have a wool allergy or a wool sensitivity, it will not allow your body to heal properly because you will just be causing more inflammation at the tissue site. Mm. So if something like that, if you suspect that, if you think that might be happening, definitely switch it up and try something different because it's not right for everyone for sure.
Yeah, good. That's a good question. Okay. Is it okay to take melatonin to help with sleep during pregnancy?
This is tricky. I don't know. What are your thoughts on melatonin? I've kind of peeled away from melatonin recently.
Well,
being a little suspicious, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, I typically only like to use melatonin in extreme situations, like in traveling. If you have a severe circadian rhythm upset, I do find that melatonin can be really helpful to get you to sleep really well if you have just changed time zones. I don't personally love using it as a sleep aid without finding the root cause of why you're not making melatonin in the first place or what else could be supporting that. In fertility, if you are going through IVF, melatonin can be helpful because it has been shown to improve egg and embryo quality. However, it can disrupt ovulation. So if you are trying to conceive naturally, you probably don't want to be taking a lot of melatonin. I instead encourage the practices that allow for better sleep, blocking blue light and, you know, sleeping with an eye mask, not having screens on before bed, all of the things that naturally boost melatonin versus taking it. With pregnancy, you know, we just want to be very conservative, in my opinion, with taking any hormones during pregnancy is my kind of perspective. Yeah. If it's so extreme or your melatonin is so low to the point where you're not sleeping and that's like more of a detriment to the baby and yourself, you know, and that's the only thing that can help you. I mean, I would rather take melatonin than like a pharmaceutical sleep aid, obviously, and many of them you can't take during pregnancy. But I would say try the other things first.
Yeah.
And maybe check your melatonin and only take it if you actually don't make enough versus just taking it because you want to sleep and now you're getting extra melatonin.
Yeah, I think I'm sort of hesitant Similar. I agree with you. I'm like, there's other things we can do before that. And because it is interrupting, it's a hormone. And, you know, if you have cancer or you have COVID, you're not pregnant, you're not nursing. Melatonin is a really wonderful supplement and it has a huge anti-inflammatory effects and all sorts of different things. But in the time of pregnancy, and I understand pregnancy insomnia is a thing, especially towards the third trimester or towards those final weeks and you're really uncomfortable, I would rather choose something like higher dose magnesium or like Livella, which is by Integrative Therapeutics, something like that that can help kind of put that sleep pressure on you, or even herbs. Like you could take, you know, valerian and California, no, maybe not California poppy, but you know, there's different ones that I would try differently over that. I don't think that it's like, oh yeah, I take melatonin every single night. I don't know.
Yeah. And Needed has a really great sleep support formula with L-theanine and some other things that are safe for pregnancy. So something like that I would try first.
Beautiful.
Okay.
Okay. Here's one. Thoughts on fulvic acid bath soaks. The fulvic acid bath soak trend to pull parasites and heavy metals out of the body. I don't know about that.
I mean, fulvic acid is a binder. I mean, I haven't used it in baths.
You have to take it internally. I can't imagine that taking a bath is going to
I don't know.
I don't know about that enough. I would say there's definitely more efficient ways to detox parasites and heavy metals out of your body. That's like probably – I wouldn't – maybe it helps, but – I definitely know of other ways to help with that problem in probably much more efficient ways, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I don't know. I'd have to look more. I don't know about the bath trend with the fulvic acid. I know that fulvic acid internally can be helpful for detoxing and binding and stuff. But if you're going to take any sort of bath, I mean, this is like super controversial, but I've been doing the ionic foot baths. And they are supposedly very good at getting things out of the body, and weird stuff comes out of me, supposedly.
Are they controversial? That's so silly. Why are they controversial?
I mean, anyone in the conventional model just thinks anything that does anything is controversial.
That's true.
Especially like, does it actually do anything? Like, is it actually coming out? Because it is hard to believe what you see in the baths. But I bought one and I have one and I do it in prep for pregnancy. And so I would recommend that. It's super easy and safe, and or don't do it when you're pregnant though, obviously.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, so how, let's see, we've already done that.
Do you stand by the less than 200 milligrams of caffeine per day rule? So this is, I think, in reference to pregnancy.
Probably.
And yes, I do. Definitely do. Studies show that over 300 milligrams of caffeine per day in the first trimester is associated with an increased risk in miscarriage. And so what I tend to recommend is less than 200, just be safe on that side. Also, 200 milligrams of caffeine is like a lot. Like, we don't, you know, it's one cup of coffee has between what, 80 and 120, something like that, depending on how strong it's brewed. So a cup or a cup and a half, you know, you can be pretty safe with. And ideally, if we're really needing a lot more than that, we need to be working on other lifestyle factors. Yeah. I do drink a cup of coffee every single morning. I drink one cup. If I drink more than that, I would feel like crap. Mm-hmm. And I load my coffee up with stuff. It's like a whole thing for me. But
yeah,
I do think that that's actually pretty important.
Yeah. And if this is in the trying to conceive time, there are mixed reviews on caffeine and fertility, but the consensus is it does seem to impact it some. And it's hard to tease out if it's the caffeine itself or if it's the beverages that the caffeine is in, like sodas and, you know, pesticide laden coffee and sugary beverages that have caffeine and energy drinks and those kind of things. But
yeah, for sure.
In general, the results are mixed, but from the literature that I've gleaned, especially for male fertility, because this is fresh on my mind, definitely sticking to one cup a day for female fertility as well. The only exception to that, so I agree with you. I would be working on the other factors as to why a person needs that much caffeine, which is more concerning, especially for fertility, but also for pregnancy and any time. But if you're going to choose caffeine, matcha or green tea is actually a better choice in the fertility time, because it in and of itself, green tea in and of itself, have been shown to help greatly help fertility on men and women because it's such a powerful antioxidant. So if you just need the caffeine, but you want to choose a healthier option, I would definitely choose green tea instead. And if you do choose coffee, make sure it's organic and low mold options, because the herbicides and pesticides from a fertility perspective, I think are more damaging even maybe than the caffeine. Yes. But yeah, I wouldn't go above a cup even when trying to conceive.
And I would agree that in pregnancy, if you just need caffeine and it doesn't necessarily need to be coffee, then yeah, there's other options with the teas that are safer for sure. Here's one for you. What if someone I'm around is wearing perfume and won't stop? Is that as bad as wearing it myself?
I'm just like, who are you around that won't stop? First of all, have you had a conversation with them and they like refuse to stop, or just like they are wearing it and you don't have control over them per se? So the first thing I would start with, if you are in a situation, a co-working situation or something where you are constantly being exposed, I would first have a conversation with them, but in a really kind way. And again, ask permission and say, you know, hey, Becky, are you open to me chatting with you about something that's been bothering me? And if she says yes, sure, you know, sure, of course, then she has given you energetic permission to share with her what has been bothering you. If she says no, or you try to have the conversation with her without asking permission, she's going to be on the defensive and it's typically not going to go super well. So that's the first thing I would say, is ask permission and then say, you know what, I love working next to you. You know, let's just say it's a coworker. I love working next to you. You know, you're super fun. So do the compliment sandwich. So this is another way to bring up conflict, is you say something positive and then you drop the news that's not as positive. And then you end it with a positive. So do the ask permission compliment sandwich. So compliment her on something, whatever. I love working next to you. You're such a great friend. You're such a blah, 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 whatever. And then say, the issue is I have been realizing more and more, I've been reading or I've seen on Instagram or I've been experiencing how damaging the chemicals in perfume are to our health. And if you're trying to conceive, you could say something along the lines of, and I, you know, I'm trying to conceive and, you know, I've been just reading some really crazy studies about how phthalates and fragrance can impact my hormones and my baby's hormones. And or, you know, impact libido or testosterone, whatever is important to you. Or, you know, it's unfortunate, but I think that the perfume that you're wearing, you know, is giving me a headache every day. And or
which is really like,
it's a total legit thing. And
a lot of people have that. Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's whatever your concern is, you know, if it's fertility, if you're trying to conceive, if it's that you actually feel sick, you know, I feel like physically ill around perfume and fragrance products. And I don't say this because like, I don't want you to feel bad, or I don't want you to, you know, to feel like I'm offending you or anything. It's just, we co-share this space. And I want you to be have the autonomy to do what you want and to wear the things that you want. However, your choices, because they are in the air and we share the same air, are really affecting me and my health. Like, would you be open to potentially like not wearing perfume at work when we're together or whatever? It would greatly help me. And honestly, I don't know if I can continue to work here if you don't, because it's affecting my health that much. So something like, you know, bring the gravity of the situation and then say, but, you know, obviously, you know, whatever, end with a compliment, however, whatever relationship you have with this.
It smells really good. It just is giving me a headache and I'm so sorry.
It smells really good. And
everybody's perfume is like this. And I'm sorry, you're not the only one. I've actually had to tell my mom and my sister and everybody around me.
Yeah, it's not just
you.
And
I'm kind of like that little canary in the coal mine. I'm really sorry, but you just can't wear it anymore.
Yeah, exactly. So say that. And if she refuses, you know, or she's concerned, you say, you know, what could I do to convince you? You know, do you want evidence of, you know, are you someone who really likes evidence? Like, can I present maybe some of the studies? You know, because this is really affecting me and I really can't continue to work here with, you know, in this situation. It would be similar to if you were smoking and, you know, I guess you could understand, like, you know, you wouldn't smoke right in front of me. And it's similar to me. My body processes it the same way. But I would really love to know what you would need from me to help change your mind. You know, if they give you pushback, ask them, what do you need? Because you might be a data person and be like, look at all these studies. if the person in front of you is not a data person, they're not going to care. So ask what is it that you would need to help change your mind? You know, so, yeah. You know, have these kind of conversations. And is it still affecting you? Yes, unfortunately. I wish the answer was no. Whatever someone puts into their body is their own thing. You know, if they want to drink soda and eat Twinkies and all of that, that's fine. It doesn't bother you. But whatever is aerosolized in the air in a close proximity to you, you will be absorbing into your lungs and into your body the same as if you were wearing it yourself, although, if you're that close to them.
But it probably is worse to put it on your own skin.
Yes, it's totally worse to put it on you because yes, it's like around you and it's though. On your fabric. But the way that phthalates work from perfume is they stick to stuff. So even if like a person like sitting right next to you is wearing perfume, like you'll come home and your clothes will still smell like that. That's because phthalates like stick fragrance to things. So it would be just as if you spritzed your perfume and kind of walked through it. You know, some people yeah. do that versus spraying it directly on your arm. It's not as bad, but still could be affecting your health. Sorry to say.
Oh man. Yeah. Okay. This is kind of a tricky one. I don't know if we're going to be able to answer this properly, but let's just give it a shot here. Being vulnerable, partner doesn't agree on the number of kids. I've actually had this come up in my inbox a couple of times as well. And I think you said that you had as well.
Yeah, it's interesting. And this is complicated and it would kind of depend on the person who's sitting in front of me because it's hard, I think, for both of us to understand what it's like to be in that position, to speak from our own personal experiences, because at least
it hasn't
for
come
me,
up yet.
Yeah. Like for me, you know, Mike and I, you know, obviously we struggle with infertility. We'd have as many kids as we could, but I would say sitting down again, all of these conflict resolution things, we have a lot of conflict resolution in our podcast episodes lately, is getting an idea of where they're coming from and their why. Most people have a reason for everything that they want, or everything that people want, there's typically a reason. Just like you brought up with your husband wanting to give your kids toys and candy because of how he was fathered, most people have a desire or an experience because of a desire or a fear. You know, it kind of comes down to those two things. So, or like a past like thing. So he wanted the desire to have what he didn't have as a child. So he's giving that to your children. Some people have a fear. For example, ask your partner, you know, what can you tell me authentically? And you don't interject, you know, you give them the floor to say, I want you to tell me what comes up for you when I say I want three or four kids or whatever. Let's say it's four kids and they do not want that. Can you tell me why? You know, what is coming up for you about that? And then give them the floor and don't interject and like butt in and stuff to say, what is it about four kids? And typically for most people, I would say it's like a financial issue. It's, you know, maybe they can't handle all of the craziness or they're afraid of,
or age.
You know, fatigue. A lot of it is fears or desires for, I have the desire to like be done with the baby stage and like go camping or whatever. So find out their fears and their desires and what's driving that decision.
I love that fear and desire model because you're so right. It's so different and energetically different. Is it a fear of poverty or is it a desire for financial freedom? And yeah, like wanting to travel a lot and it's hard to do that when you have more kids. You know, that's such a good way to distinguish what exactly it is.
I know. That kind of just like popped up, but I'm sure someone teaches it somewhere because nothing is new anymore. Thanks. Tell me more words of affirmation. No, but it's true because those are just the things that motivate people. And no, that's totally a thing because in marketing, it's like you market based on a fear or a desire. People move toward or away from something. So in this situation, you then share yours. Typically, yours is coming more from a desire. Obviously. Yeah. Even though you can have your own fears because you could have a fear. My fear is that we'll only have one child and that they'll be lonely or, you know, XYZ, what your fear is. Let's say you have one child and you want two or three or whatever. So share your fears and desires and put them out on the table. And then I would say you have to get to the understanding of what they want, what you want, what you're afraid of, what they're afraid of, and then unpack the fears because sometimes fears are irrational. Sometimes fears are rooted in trauma, such as, you know, I have a fear that, you know, we'll never be able to have fun, you know, because why? Where does that fear come from? Start to go deeper. Why? Why do you have that fear? Mm-hmm. And if you keep kind of pulling it out of your partner, it might come out that because, you know, our neighbors growing up had four kids and they looked miserable and yes. I never wanted that, you know, yes. which is like a total real thing, like that people yes. make up in their mind these stories of mm-hmm. if XYZ happens because I've seen it this one way, that's going to be my reality. And then start to kind of like hash out with each other, what are real practical things? Or is there a way to pivot that? Like if your partner says, well, I don't want more children because it's too much money to raise three kids. And then you say, well, I really want three kids. And like you're being held back by money. Okay. Is money something that we could create more of? Could we move to another location that's cheaper to live? Like, are there ways to move around your fears? If your only fear of not having three kids is because of finances, is there a way to move around that? So that's kind of how I would unpack it. And at the end of the day, yeah. you know, if you still like disagree, obviously one partner's going to have to cave and that's sad. But you'd first try to see if there's a common ground that you can get to. And if not, you guys have to make a decision as a partnership, who's going to be the one that has to kind of like give up their desired situation. And if that's the decision that you make as a team, then you know, have to be okay with that and maybe do your own processing around the grief of what that ends up being.
I love that. That's great. I don't really have all that much to add other than that something that I've heard from a couple people that they've done, like one of the other methods, is that they've kind of come up with, so they disagreed, somebody wanted one more, somebody didn't, or something like that. And maybe they had these types of conversations and then they gave themselves a window. They said, okay, if we don't conceive, this is obviously probably outside of the couple who's having fertility issues.
Right.
If everything is happening on par, then they give themselves a window. If it doesn't happen in the next 6 months, then we'll close the window. That yeah. I think is usually sort of a timing or an age-based reason for things. Mm-hmm. But it was sort of like maybe, hey, we're getting the age gap with our youngest is getting a little bigger and bigger. Are we going to have one more? If we're going to do it, we kind of need to do it. Otherwise, let's close the chapter and move on.
Right.
When it's wishy-washy like that. Anyway, I've heard that what works well because they're open to it, but they're not beholden. And then also something that happens is when you get to the end of that window, you either have closure and relief or you feel that longing and it gives you some more direction yeah. to point to. We did that with this whole idea of, do we want this fourth? Do we want, mm-hmm. what are we going to do? Like that. And to me, it was like, we both had the experience where we felt the spirit of one more. Mm-hmm. We knew that there was like a fourth one out there, but our third child was very difficult with her sleep situation. And I was very depleted and I was very tired. And I felt like, I honestly don't know if I can put my body through this again. I am really Vata. Mm-hmm. I love pregnancy. I love motherhood. I love all these things, but I'm not constitutionally somebody who could just pump out eight kids. I just can't. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. My vital force goes out so much to each one. And so I was really concerned about that, you know, and we would talk about, and my husband's 8 years older than I am. So I'm 33, he's 41 right now. And mm-hmm. we were just sort of like, all right, maybe when Sloan, the third one, turns two, we will reassess. And at that point say, okay, we're closing this chapter. We're moving on with three kids, or we want to like, let's do this now. Mm-hmm. Two came and went. And I was like, I still don't know. I don't feel like we can make a permanent decision, meaning like him get a vasectomy or I'm not going back on birth control. So, I mean, we just floated in that time. We mm-hmm. still did our fertility awareness method kind of thing. And there was periods of time where he was very much like, we're done. Like we can't mm-hmm. do this. I can't do this. And it's because I think we had that really difficult dynamic of three little kids is really, really tricky. And everybody talks about this. They're like, mm-hmm. once you can get past three, you're done. And now my three are all at different ages where it's so much easier. But at that time, it felt so hard, like day in and day out, both my husband and I would just mm-hmm. be like, dang, this is like so much work, you know?
Right.
And so we were not like looking for it in that moment. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, inevitably a couple months later, a spontaneous, you know, one slipped in there kind of a situation happened. Although I'm good at tracking my cycle. I knew I was ovulating, but we decided to have sex anyways, although there was no sperm going in the vagina. There is still sperm in pre-cum. Mm-hmm. And it happened. And the second that I saw that positive pregnancy test, I was like immediately happy, you know, yeah. and immediately relieved. And that was my experience. I'm sure that people have, I actually know lots of people who've had not that experience where they see the positive pregnancy test and they go, oh my God, because they didn't want another one.
Right.
And you know, this is part of life. This is a tricky part. And not to say that one is better than the other, but anyway, for me, I was happy the way that that all went down. It was, we were both like wishy-washy. Neither of us had very, very strong opinions. We were just kind of like, it was sort of like looking at a challenge that you want to do, like, you know, you want to go climb Mount Kilimanjaro or something, but you're just like, oh my gosh, can I do it? But you know, when you get to the top of the mountain, it's going to be amazing. Mm-hmm. It's just difficult to make that decision when there's a lot of challenge with it as well. I have so many breastfeeding issues, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I can't really give, we haven't ever come to like a hard stop. Right now, my husband is continually throwing out jokes that we're going to have a fifth. And I feel very much like that's not happening. I also don't feel like I think he's joking, truly. Mm-hmm. If at the end of this, we have a fourth and he's what, 43 probably by that point, and mm-hmm. he really, really wants a fifth, like that is going to be tricky because I feel very much like I do not want any more. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I guess we'll have to see. But I think that what you said, though, getting to the root of the problems, because some people just grow up and they're like, you have two kids and that's it. And that's mm-hmm. it. And they just have this like belief and there's no reason yeah. for it. And they just, that's it. They go with that. And like, maybe it's a fear of, yeah, the resources, because they were told their whole life that they don't have the resources. It's like, no, look at our situation. We can actually make this work very well. And, or I'll get a job or da, da, da. Mm-hmm. And you can really get a lot of insight there. And I just feel for the people who never end up coming to an agreement and it feeling really tough. And, you know, you're seeing, you're not alone. There's a lot of people in that position mm-hmm. and it's really tough.
Yeah. And I think what you said is good. I mean, I feel like we both have a really good answer to this complicated question and we should like tell people about it. But in the fact that your desire of how many kids you want can totally change based on the season that you're in. So mm-hmm. it could be even before you have kids, if your partner is going through a lot of stress at work, or if, you know, maybe something's not going super well financially or at work or whatever, then he might be like, you know, we're only having one child or whatever. Versus if you, once you have kids and you have two or three, and maybe you're like in the like heart of the hard time of sleep, like continually check in and keep asking your partner, you know, you made this decision. We talked about this 6 months ago when our child wasn't sleeping. Like, do you still feel the exact same way? Because sometimes people will just put in their mind, like, we've decided on the two, we're not having a third. And
right.
yet they never actually sit back and reevaluate with themselves of, okay, did you make that decision when you were in a really hard place in your life? Mm-hmm. And those places, now that you've experienced, they come and go. You know, and so just again, getting to the root of it, because if someone does say that their fear is, well, I don't think that we'll, you know, sleep and blah, 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 like those things come and go. And like, what do you want? What do you value more? And just getting to your values. And yeah, there's like,
yes, a whole exactly. Like looking at the long-term view of things, like where do you want to be when you're 65? Do you want to be surrounded by a lot of kids and grandchildren and da, da, da? I mean, can we get through a temporary difficult sleeping time? It's a big decision. It's mm-hmm. huge and it's mm-hmm. tough. Very personal. I think regrets are really, really tricky to deal with. And that was one thing that my husband and I agreed with, is that we agreed we would never regret another child. Mm-hmm. We really saw that as true. We have our three beautiful kids and we're just more infatuated and obsessed with them every single day. And it's like, mm-hmm. even though the newborn time is really hard for me and who knows how this one will sleep, we know at some point we'll get through that mm-hmm. and then we'll have another team member. We'll have this other child. And yeah, there's just a lot to consider with this. And so we really feel you wherever you're at. And thank you for listening in on part two of our Q&A series. We will be doing these every once in a while. Be sure to look out in our stories for a Q&A box, or you can go ahead and direct message us questions that are maybe not long enough for their entire episode to be dedicated to an entire episode, but they're too long for just a quick little direct message or even answer box on our stories. We do that all the time as well. We're trying to answer as many of your guys' questions as we possibly can. But anyways, so we will be doing these. Keep an eye out for that and have a great day.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Healthy as a Mother podcast.
In order for other women to hear this information, please leave a review with Apple Podcasts, subscribe, and send to a friend who could benefit from this content.
We're so excited to share more on becoming and being a mother next time. And remember, a healthier future starts now, and it starts with you.
Please remember that the ideas and views presented in this podcast are for informational purposes only and are not intended to serve as a substitute for medical care of any kind. including the diagnosis or treatment of any illness or disease. Consult with your provider before integrating this information into your own care plan. Now go have a wonderful day. You've got this.